thousands of people march in Washington, D.C. to back the U.S. president's claims of election fraud as he pushes ahead with legal challenges to overturn his rival's victory. Russia reports a record daily increase of nearly 23,000 new coronavirus infections, taking the national tally to nearly 2 million. And German police fire water cannons to disperse protesters out in Frankfurt against the government's measures to halt the rise in coronavirus infections. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, supporters of the U.S. president have held a mass protest in Washington, D.C. against what they describe as vote rigging. USA! USA! Various far-right groups and militias, including the Proud Boys, took part in the protest. Demonstrators urged Trump not to concede defeat to Democratic rival Joe Biden. Trump personally drove through the cheering crowd in his motorcade, waving to protesters. He later tweeted that people are not going to stand for having their election stolen by the radical left. Joe Biden was proclaimed by the media as winner of the 2020 presidential vote Saturday. However, Trump has rejected the result and launched legal challenges based on claims of fraud. Our correspondent in Washington, D.C., Wyatt Reed, says small scuffles broke out during the rally between Trump supporters and counter-protesters.
Well, I'm out here outside Harry's Restaurant and Hotel Harrington. It's long been known as a hangout, a favorite hangout of the Proud Boys. And true to form, they are here today. Probably at least 100 of them have been congregating at the corner here. Now, I have noticed over the past half hour, small scuffles, interactions, arguments with those who are opposed to Donald Trump, to his presidency, and what they describe as his racist, white supremacist policies. The Proud Boys themselves have been going through internal divisions with a significant wing, wishing that they would stop, as he saw it, and Enrique Tarrio saw it, stop disguising their beliefs in the language of Western chauvinism and just begin openly identifying as white supremacists. There's a significant number within the Proud Boys that feel very strongly in favor of that suggestion. And we're seeing some of it tonight. You know, lots of racially loaded language being used, lots of suggestions about welfare being thrown around at black people. They are using sort of the dog whistles that we've come to expect.
As pressure mounts on the U.S. President Donald Trump to cede power, some are rushing to take advantage of the limited time he possibly has in office, and one of these parties is Israel. Regime is speeding up the construction of settlements, but does it really matter who is in the White House, as Tel Aviv has historically enjoyed unprecedented support from Washington?
Israel is pressing ahead with yet more settlement construction in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. The regime is planning to expand three settlements, paving the way for more Israeli squatters to occupy Palestinian land. The latest move will cut off two Palestinian neighborhoods from each other in the Holy City, namely Beit Safafa and Sharafa. This comes on the heels of another major settlement in addition to more settler units announced by Israel earlier this week and last month. An ever-increasing pattern with the regime and the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump's 4 years in office. Critics say the White House's so-called deal of the century, with the support of Persian Gulf monarchies, gave Tel Aviv everything it ever wanted, including the green light for settlement expansion, while denying the Palestinians their main demands. The human rights group Ir Amim says Netanyahu's cabinet is taking advantage of the end of Trump's term in order to implement a quick step that would prevent at any cost a future political settlement. This is in line with Tel Aviv's policy of gravely violating Palestinian rights under Trump's watch. However, critics argue that Israel has always pursued settlement expansion, even before Trump took power.
Yeah, that's exactly the case. I can't imagine why they would rush to do this before the Biden inauguration. They will have the permission to do this almost any time they want to.
Under the era of Obama's presidency, the Israeli regime cut back settlement activity but never stopped its land grab policy. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. However, Tel Aviv has time and again defied calls to end the practice, and under President Trump, the regime has carried out record levels of settlement activity and at the same time vastly increased the demolition of Palestinian homes. This is while the Trump White House has taken drastic measures in support of Israel at the alarm of the international community.
Some of the Trump measures supporting Israel include the declaration of occupied Jerusalem al Quds as the capital of Israel, relocating the U.S. embassy there, and recognition of the occupied Syrian territory of the Golan Heights as belonging to Israel. And, of course, expanding Israeli settlements while demolishing more Palestinian homes and structures. In fact, last year, Washington sparked global outcry by saying it didn't consider settlements as illegal. A call by the European Union to end the practice of demolitions have fallen on deaf ears, even if EU-funded schools have, not even if, even European Union-funded schools have been demolished. So with Joe Biden presidency looking more likely now to be on the horizon, will it spell any kind of hope or relief for the Palestinians?
Reports suggest Israel is rushing the expansion of settlements before President Joe Biden enters the Oval Office. In fact, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is scheduled to visit the occupied Golan Heights as well as Israeli settlements next week. This would be a first for a U.S. Secretary of State and gives an idea of the level of cooperation between the Trump White House and Israeli officials over the regime's land grab policy. Pompeo's visit comes 1 year after he said the U.S. did not consider settlements on occupied Palestinian land to be illegal, putting Washington at odds with UN Security Council resolutions and almost all other countries. It has also been strongly condemned by the Palestinians. While it is true that President Obama publicly called on Israel to end the construction of settler units, historically, no US president has ever stood in the way of Israeli settlement activity. Biden, in fact, has praised the normalization deals between Arab dictatorships and Israel, something that critics say has further encouraged the Israeli regime to construct more settlements. So how will Biden deal with Israeli violation of Palestinian rights, including the demolitions, land confiscations, the razing of entire villages, and settlement expansion? Analysts say there are no indications that Biden will be any different from previous U.S. administrations.
This is not about Washington permitting Israel to do anything. If anything, it's more about Israel permitting Washington to do some things. And this is exactly what Trump found when he got in the White House in the 2016 campaign. He was very anti-war. He was against the Iraq war. He was against having troops in Afghanistan and all this sort of thing. So, but it was Israel that basically and its allies in the government, the neoconservatives and the Zionists, the Zionist lobby in the U.S. that prevented Trump from doing what he wanted.
Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris are longtime supporters of Israel. While 4 more years of Trump would have been a disaster for Palestine, the return of a more liberal leader to the Oval Office will do the job for the Israeli regime just as well. For the Palestinians, it may be time to dump the U.S. once and for all and look elsewhere to find peace, security, and the liberation of their land.
As turmoil over the presidential election continues in the U.S., it's easy to forget the coronavirus and a gutted economy are also serious issues facing Americans. Now seems certain that much-needed second stimulus package will not arrive until sometime in 2021, on top of other problems across the country. Rami Mazahiri reports from Chicago.
The United States is in turmoil, seemingly everywhere one looks. Trump's unprecedented insistence that the vote undergo a judicial review is causing unprecedented soul-searching about the integrity of elections, which Harvard's Electoral Integrity Project called, in 2019, the worst among the Western core democracies.
What Trump did that you simply don't do in the United States in a government of two capitalist parties is that he questioned the legitimacy of the election process. And between two capitalist parties, it's in both of their interests to maintain order, to maintain that legitimacy. And by him calling out the process, you've seen that people, some of his biggest cheerleaders like Fox News, the Wall Street Journal editorial board, they have distanced themselves from Trump. Some like Fox News even going as far as aligning with the other media, saying that Joe Biden is the president-elect.
Adding to the political chaos is that the expected second wave of coronavirus continues to rage. That leads to more lockdown measures, which exacerbates the ongoing economic disaster, so Americans have many reasons to be concerned. Many areas will start stay-at-home advisories, not orders, next week. The Trump administration has backed off from second stimulus negotiations, leaving it entirely in the hands of a divided Congress. Record unemployment and 9 months of uneven and economically devastating lockdowns has made a second stimulus so important for so long, but households now shouldn't hope for assistance until perhaps February 2021. But it's a judicial review of the presidential vote which seems to be at the top of everyone's list. And it's supported by not just conservatives, but many independents and leftists as well.
They have to absolutely count every vote. They have to verify the wins that, you know, the media projected that these wins to be. It has to be set in stone. The United States has a track record of very weird, not great elections. The world sees this. The people of the United States sees this. This would be a good opportunity for both parties to kind of say, like, look, we have to set this in stone. We have to look at every single vote, and we have to come out and announce a winner. We can't let the media decide who is the projected winner. That's for certain.
Many are refusing to postpone electoral integrity questions any longer, but many Democrats are insisting that there was no vote fraud and that Biden is the president-elect. Rami Mazahiri, Chicago.
The COVID-19 pandemic continues to wreak havoc across the Americas, where countries are struggling to contain a second wave of spread of the virus. According to Johns Hopkins University's tally, U.S.'s total death toll has surpassed 245,000, with the confirmed cases nearing 10,900,000. Surge in cases has prompted several states to announce new restrictions. On Friday, the U.S. reported a record of over 184,000 new cases in a single day. In Brazil, officials there registered over 38,000 new cases, raising the country's total infections to nearly 5.85 million. They also reported over 900,000, that is, new deaths, taking their death toll to about 165,000. Both the U.S. president and his Brazilian counterpart have come under sharp criticism for mishandling the pandemic. COVID-19 infections and deaths continue to rise across Europe despite restrictions imposed by governments to curb the pandemic. France has registered over 32,000 new cases in 24 hours to reach a total of nearly 960,000. Over 44,000 more people have also died from the disease in French hospitals. Greece announced the closure of primary schools, kindergartens, and daycare centers as coronavirus deaths topped 1,000. The country has reported over 72,500 cases. In Russia, the daily infections there hit an all-time high of nearly 23,000 total infections, exceeding 1.9 million. Austria says it'll move from its current nighttime coronavirus curfew and partial shutdown to a full lockdown from Tuesday until December the 6th. Now, well, Leslie, give us an update about the coronavirus situation in Europe.
We just had here in Austria a crucial press conference that everybody was waiting for, where the announcement was made that Austria is now going to go into full lockdown mode, similar to the one that we saw here in spring. Now, the reason being that despite the fact that Austria has been imposing a partial lockdown over the past couple of weeks, it apparently hasn't helped, and cases are increasing. In fact, the health minister said that new infections were growing rapidly at an explosive pace, as he put it, and he said that actually the second wave of the coronavirus or COVID-19 infections is more dynamic, in his words, and more dangerous, and that's why we need to take this action. He said that while in spring, the fact that the full lockdown brought about up to 50 to 75% reduction of mobility, we did not see the same effect of the partial, because of the partial lockdown, and that's why the government has decided to go ahead with this, despite, of course, the economic costs that it's going to have. But you see shops and stores and everything is going to be closed, as well as the restaurants and bars. The schools are going to switch to distance learning, etc.
German police have used water cannons to disperse protesters during a protest against lockdowns in Frankfurt. Police said the rally was broken up after protesters repeatedly disregarded distancing measures. Protest was attended by hundreds of people from the Kehr den Kehr movement, which opposes the government's measures to lock down the country. Police clashed with a group of counter-protesters who blocked the route of the rally several times. German health ministers warned that even with current stringent measures, that lowering the infection rate will take quite some time. The country so far reported over 788,000 coronavirus cases and more than 12,000 deaths. Austria's Muslim community says the government's attempt to criminalize what it terms political Islam is alarming. Following the Vienna terror attack, the Austrian government has presented a package of proposals which includes keeping detainees in prison indefinitely, closing mosques, and tracking imams. Homo Lesgi has your details.
Just over a week after the Vienna terror attack, Austria's government proposed legislation to keep terrorism detainees locked up indefinitely. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz called them ticking time bombs.
Like mentally abnormal lawbreakers, we will also make it possible in the future to block these people's path and thus protect the population from them.
But the most controversial part of the new measures is the creation of a new criminal offence that the government calls political Islam. If approved, this law would make it easier to close mosques or detain imams on charges of creating the breeding ground for terrorism. The Islamic faith community of Austria, representing around 700,000 people, says some of the measures are incompatible with the constitution and fundamental human rights. Prominent Muslim personalities have raised alarm on social media. The Muslim population has the impression that the term political Islam is used as a kind of code to send signals to certain groups of voters and foster resentment. There can't be a penalty that addresses only one religion, an activist said. The Muslim community is still deeply shocked by the terrorist attack.
Islamic cemeteries here denied the perpetrator of the Vienna attack a funeral to show that they not only strongly condemn the attack, but also the perpetrator who carried out the crime in the name of Islam. The imams of mosques here instead carried the casket of a young Muslim who was among the four people killed.
But in the days following the attack, more Muslims are reporting cases of abuse, both on the streets and on social media. The important thing now, says the Islamic community, is that society does not allow itself to be divided. Homa Lesky, Vienna.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Chunk 5 has just one lunar day to collect lunar material from a previously unexplored region of the moon's near side. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by the staff of Nature website, which is published under the heading China Set to Retrieve First Moon Rocks in 40 Years. Stay tuned, please. Later this month, November, a Chinese spacecraft will travel to the moon to scoop up lunar rocks for the first time in more than 40 years. The mission named Chang'e 5 is the latest in a series of increasingly complex trips to the lunar surface led by the China National Space Administration, CNSA, following its first touchdown of a craft, Chang'e 4, on the moon's far side last year, 2019. To take it to the next level and return samples from the moon is a significant technological capability, says Caroline Vanderburger, a planetary geologist at the University of Münster, Germany. The craft is expected to take off on November 24th from the Wuchang Satellite Launch Center on Hainan Island. Its original launch, planned for 2017, was delayed because of an engine failure in China's Long March 5th launch rocket. Chang'e 5 mission is to collect dust and debris from a previously unexplored region of the moon's near side and return them to Earth. If the mission is successful, it will retrieve the first lunar material since the US and Soviet missions in 1960s and 1970s. Lunar scientists will be eager to study the new samples because of what they might learn about the moon's evolution. The material could also help researchers more accurately date the surfaces of planets such as Mars and Mercury. The landing site was extremely wisely picked, says Harold Heisinger, a geologist at the University of Münster. Chang'e 5 includes a lander, ascender, orbiter, and returner. After the spacecraft enters the moon's orbit, the lander and ascender pair will split off and descend close to Mons Rümker, a 1,300-meter-high volcanic complex in northern region of Oceanus Proclamorum, the vast dark lava plains visible from Earth. Once the craft has touched down, it will drill up to 2 meters into the ground and extend a robotic arm to scoop up about 2 kilograms of surface material. The material will be stored in the ascender for liftoff. The descent and ascent will take place over one lunar day, which is equivalent to around 14 Earth days, to avoid the extreme overnight temperatures that could damage electronics, says Clive Neal, a geoscientist at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. The mission is technically challenging and many things could go wrong, says Neil. The lander could crash land or topple over, and the samples could escape from their canister along the way. We all hope that it works, he says. Once the ascender is back in lunar orbit, the samples will be transferred to the returner. This in-flight rendezvous will be complex and a good rehearsal for future human exploration, says James Carpenter, a research coordinator for human and robotic exploration at the European Space Agency in Norwich, Netherlands. China plans to send people at the moon from around 2030. Chang-5 spacecraft will then journey back to Earth with the lander parachuting toward CZ-1 banner in Inner Mongolia, northern China, probably sometime in early December. Most of the lunar samples will be stored at the Chinese Academy of Sciences National Astronomical Observatory of China, NAOC, in Beijing, says Li Chunlai, deputy chief designer for Chang-5 mission. Some material will be stored at a separate site, safe from natural hazards, and some will be set aside for public display, says Li. But it is not clear whether samples will leave the country. The CNSA supports international collaboration and giving researchers outside China access to the samples if they work with Chinese scientists, says Xiao Long, a planetary geologist at the China University of Geosciences in Wuhan, who was involved in selecting the landing site. Hessinger hopes that access to the samples will be similar to how researchers access rocks collected by the U.S. Apollo missions by submitting a proposal to NASA on how they plan to use them. But Xiao points out that scientists at Chinese institutions cannot access Apollo samples because the U.S. government restricts NASA from collaborating directly with China. The Chang-5 samples could fill an important gap in scientists' understanding of the moon's volcanic activity. Rocks obtained by previous U.S. and Soviet lunar missions suggest that activity on the moon peaked 3.5 billion years ago, then fizzled and stopped. But observations of the lunar surface have uncovered regions that could contain volcanic lava formed as recently as 1 billion or 2 million years ago. If Chang's five samples confirm that the moon was still active during this time, we will rewrite the history of the moon, says Xiao. Studying the rock's composition could also clarify what fueled this thermal activity for so long. The moon is small, so its heat engine should have run out a long time ago, says Neil. The moon is also an important reference for dating other planets, based on the method of counting craters. The general rule is that older regions have more and larger craters, whereas younger regions have fewer and smaller ones. These relative ages are then given absolute dates using samples from the moon. But no samples exist for the period between 850 million years and 3.2 billion years ago. Chang'e could fill that gap. The moon is the only place where we have samples that we know exactly where they came from, says Van der Bogert.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين. First of all, I would like to appreciate your presence, and I'm going to talk tonight about one important subject. Tonight, with the help of Almighty God, I'm going to start explaining some of the teachings that we have about nurturing and educating good and righteous descendants and children. We have to start with what we have about marriage, because in order to have good children, good offspring, you have to marry a good partner, a good spouse. In this regard also, we have many narrations. The next point, the role of what we eat, the role of food in our children. Whether if it is lawful or unlawful, we have recommendation of pure and halal food. And not only in general halal food is recommended and advised by our Prophet and our Imams, rather they have mentioned some particular types of food. And I briefly mentioned some of those things that are mentioned in our traditions and narrations. There are some particular things are recommended for father to consume before planning for having a child, or at the time of planning of having a child. The first thing is called in our narration safarjal. Some authors have translated safarjal as purr. But when we study more and deeper, we come to this conclusion that probably the best translation for this word, or the best equivalent of this word, is quince and not purr. Mostly purr is called in Arabic language kumathra, or some other words like this. So quince is recommended to be eaten by the father. And the scent of quince is the scent of prophets of God, the scent of the lady Fatima al-Zahra, and it gives us the result of having a good and beautiful child, even with good morals and characteristics. This is the first thing. The second thing that is recommended to be eaten is sawiq. Sawiq is a dish, is a food made of wheat flour and barley. These two are main ingredients of sawiq. It gives the child as well as mother strength and as I told you, both father and mother are recommended to eat this food.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
The third thing, which is once again recommended to be eaten, sweet pomegranate. Sweet pomegranate. Actually, our pomegranate in Qom normally is not sweet. But if you have this chance to find a sweet one, once again, it is recommended to be eaten, actually by the father. These three things, mostly the father is recommended to eat them. But what about the mother? As I told you, we have the same recommendation in addition to some other particular things. The first thing that the mother is recommended to eat is a tamr or date. This is the first thing, especially at the end of pregnancy, she's recommended to eat it. The next thing that is once again very important is al-luban. We call in Persian language al-luban, we call it kondor. And the equivalent of al-luban in English is frankincense. Frankincense is the equivalent of al-luban in English. The result of eating frankincense is strengthening of intellect to all of the children. And it is interesting to know that when a pregnant woman consumes al-luban, when the child is a boy, it gives the child strengthening of heart, knowledge, and bravery. The boy will be brave, knowledgeable, and a strengthened heart. And if the child is going to be a girl, frankincense is going to give her beauty and good morals and characteristics. In addition to what I said earlier, to both of them, both girl and boy, it gives strength of intellect.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears.
Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Okay, thank you very much for your good attention and your time. God bless you all, and I ask Almighty God to strengthen our faith in Him and give us this tawfiq and success to know our duties and responsibilities and to be real followers of our Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, and our Imams, and having good children exactly in accordance with their recommendations and teachings. Thank you very much. رحم الله من قرأ الفاتحة مع الصلوات.
فرش التراب يضمني وهو غطائي، حولي الرمال تلفني بل من ورائي، واللحد يحكي ظلمة فيها ابتلاء،
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
A new report commissioned by New York State Courts found substantial racism throughout the state's court system. The report recalls egregious stories of racial bias, such as white court officers posting racist images on social media using the N-word, or judges mistaking black attorneys for criminal defendants. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jensen Wu, writer. This article is published under the heading Pervasive Racial Bias in U.S. Courts, requires transformative social change. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A new report commissioned by New York State Courts found substantial racism throughout the state's court system. The report recalls egregious stories of racial bias, such as white court officers posting racist images on social media using the N-word, or judges mistaking black attorneys for criminal defendants. This report reflects a growing chorus of state courts throughout the U.S. grappling with how to best address systematic racism. While the revelations in the New York report may feel like a splash of cold water to some and generate eye rolls from others, ultimately it only stretches the surface of the pervasive racism in the United States of America judiciary. The judicial branch of government is supposed to be unbiased, fair, and impartial. After all, it is the non-political branch of government. But what if it is not? The passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 2020, followed by the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett to the United States Supreme Court, has spotlighted the deeply consequential role of the judiciary in challenging or perpetuating systematic racism. Indeed, the pursuit of equal justice under the law also requires the federal and state court systems more broadly to confront the reality of systematic racism and to take action. Over the past decade, a growing number of state courts have created anti-bias initiatives for state court judges, court officers, and juries. At the same time that anti-bias trainings have become more commonplace in the United States, the Trump administration is set on reversing course by fervently attacking anti-racist public discourse. On September 22nd, Trump signed an executive order barring federal contractors from workplace trainings that discuss racial and gender bias or that teach critical race theory. Despite the efforts of the Trump administration to restrict anti-racist discourse, state courts all across the U.S. have issued statements acknowledging institutional racism, implicit bias, and the need for collective action. In fact, the New York report on racial bias in the courts was commissioned by New York State Chief Judge Janet D. Fior, precisely in response to the black uprisings in 2020. The revelations in the report show a pattern of bias that pervades the court system. The legal team that prepared the report interviewed almost 300 people throughout the court system. Unsurprisingly, similar accounts of pervasive bias exist in other jurisdictions. In California, the Commission on Judicial Performance documents a vast compilation of judicial misconduct involving rampant bias. Another judge referred to a black defendant as a good boy. And another judge told a defense attorney who was born in Ecuador to lose the accent. The totality of these cases of racial bias break the misconception that bias is aberrational or isolated to a single individual, court, house, or state. as important as identifying and challenging interpersonal bias in the court is, systematic racism is more than simply interpersonal bias or prejudice between individuals. One of critical race theory's most significant critique of traditional anti-discrimination law is of how narrowly the law defines racism and racialized harm, and what are legally permissible remedies for that harm. Legal scholar Alan Freeman calls this the perpetrator perspective, a perspective that sees racial discrimination not as conditions, but as perspective, actions or series of actions inflicted on the victim by the perpetrator. It ignores the conditions that produce discrimination to begin with. In contrast, Freeman provides an alternative view of discrimination called the victim perspective, where racial discrimination describes those conditions of actual social existence as a member of a perpetual underclass. The victim approach to racial discrimination suggests that the problem will not be solved until the conditions associated with it have been eliminated. This approach individualizes racism as harm committed by a perpetrator against a victim. Similarly, Kimberly Crenshaw, a founding critical race theorist and law professor, wrote in Race Reform and Retrenchment, Transformation and Legitimation in Anti-Discrimination Law that civil rights and laws need to address the societal commitment to the eradication of the substantive conditions of black subordination. While the New York report gestures to some of the institutional dimensions of racism in the U.S. courts, it just does not go far enough. Specifically, the report acknowledges how under-resourced and overburdened the courts are, especially in the housing, family, civil, and criminal courts in New York City, whose litigants are disproportionately people of color. The report will even use words like dehumanizing and second-class system of justice to describe the experience for litigants of color in court. But the scope of the report is largely focused on issues of bias and addressing incidents of interpersonal discrimination, and its recommendations are limited to anti-bias trainings and developing protocols for bias complaints. We must be clear that court reforms to address interpersonal racial bias only scratch the surface of systematic racism. As important as anti-bias trainings and developing complaints protocols are, like increasing judicial diversity, such measures only address the symptoms, but not the root causes of systematic racial inequality. The solutions we need require changing the conditions that reproduce racial inequality. This includes changing laws and policies and redistribution of resources away from policing and prisons to investment in housing, education, jobs, and healthcare for directly impacted communities. In criminal court, what were the conditions that precipitated the defendant arrest? There is racial profiling and racially disparate treatment in policing, to prosecution, and in every step of the criminal legal system. There is racially disparate policing for all kinds of offenses like fare evasion, the more recently social distancing. Until we reckon with racist policing of black and Latino communities and criminalization of poverty, nothing will change. Court reforms to address interpersonal racial bias only scratch the surface of systematic racism. In housing court, what were the conditions that precipitated a tenant's rental arrest? How does the racial wealth gap, ongoing racial discrimination in U.S. in hiring and employment opportunities and pay Disparities on the basis of race and gender affect housing insecurity. And even during this pandemic, there are higher deaths in the U.S., more layoffs in the U.S., and unemployment among communities of color, again, in the United States of America. The economic consequences of these conditions are what produce disproportionate housing insecurity and homelessness for black and brown communities. This analysis can be applied to other courts and legal proceedings that disproportionately regulate the lives of low-income communities of color in the United States. Until we address the systematic nature of racism in the U.S. on all fronts, nothing will substantially change in U.S. courts alone. Kimberly Crenshaw once said, "When there is no name for a problem, you can't see a problem. When you can't see a problem, you can't solve it." Exposing racial bias in the courts is important work, and we must duly reckon with explicit and implicit bias of judges, attorneys, juries, and court officers. Simultaneously, we must see that systematic racism in the United States and its courts go beyond interpersonal bias. Racism operates in the U.S. court system because of the pervasive and systematic nature of racism in the United States society at large. Only by confronting the full reality of systematic racism in the U.S. can we craft recommendations and implement solutions that address the root causes of racism in the U.S. and not simply mitigate its symptoms.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.